It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickard is off today. Coming up, politicians on the right and left alike often invoke the founding fathers to support their ideas. We'll talk to a historian, says those references are often misguided. First, over the past four decades, David Axelrod has managed strategy for more than 150 local, state, and national campaigns. He was a senior consultant to then-Senator Barack Obama when he successfully ran for president in 2008 and for re-election in 2012. After that 2012 campaign, Axelrod founded the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago. He just came out with a new book titled Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. He joins us from our WPR studios in Milwaukee. David Axelrod, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, 40 years, you've seen the gritty side of politics up close, a dysfunction in politics, politicians like John Edwards and Rod Blagojevich ending their careers in scandal, but you still call yourself a believer in the potential for politics and democracy. How do you keep the believer side going and not being overwhelmed by cynicism?
Well, I really do believe. I wanted the subtitle of the book to be How My Idealism Survived 40 Years in Politics. And that's really what this book is about, because for all of the people that you've mentioned, I got a chance to work closely with Barack Obama over all these years. I've had a chance to work with people like Senator Paul Simon in Illinois, like Tom Vilsack in Iowa, and Deval Patrick in Massachusetts, and people who I think are just exemplary public servants. You know, I always say the world of politics divides into two categories, one more numerous than the other. The first category is made up of people who run for public office because they want to be something. And then there's this smaller, more admirable cohort of people who run for public office because they want to do something, because they see politics as a calling, as a way to grab the wheel of history and turn it into the right direction. And those are the people who I've been attracted to, and they're the people who tend to get important things done.
Do you see your work as a calling? When did that calling start, if so?
Well, my story and this book begins when I was 5 years old, actually, and John F. Kennedy came to my housing development in New York City when he was campaigning for president in 1962, 12 days before the presidential election. And it shows you how long ago it was that a Democratic candidate was actually campaigning in New York City 12 days before a presidential election. I was taken out to this event, and the woman who took care of me put me on top of a mailbox, and I watched the street fill in, and I watched JFK jump up on a platform and start talking, and his voice was booming off the buildings, and everybody was watching with rapt attention. And I could sense, even as a child, there's something important about this. And he talked about the fact that being an American citizen in the 1960s was a hazardous occupation, and that we had a chance to choose which direction we were going to take. And that's the way I view politics. I think politics is our chance to determine the kind of future in which we want to live. And his brother said, the future's not a gift. His brother Robert, his future's not a gift. It's an achievement. That's what I believe. And I think politics is the way you achieve the future.
Comparing then to now, do you think fewer politicians, fewer people in the political business see this as a calling, feel this as a calling?
I think there are elements to politics that have changed, and not for the better. First of all, in that era when JFK emerged, you had the World War II generation, and everyone had been involved in that effort, Republicans and Democrats, rural and urban, people of all different backgrounds fighting shoulder to shoulder for freedom. And so even as people disagreed in that post-war era, they did so generally with respect for each other's commitment to the country. Some of that has gone out of our politics. Too often, instead of just having disagreements, we find ourselves trying to disqualify each other, really disqualify each other as Americans. You've seen with President Obama this persistent effort to even challenge his citizenship. So that's a discouraging part of our politics. I don't think the media environment has helped either. And I think there are more temptations for people to become public officials in order to become instant celebrities, instant TV stars. Having said all that, as I said, I've met more than a few really good people in politics who are determined to make a difference and have made a difference. And even in my experience with Obama, you know, I served in the White House for 2 years at the beginning of his administration, and I've worked with him over the years. You know, for all of the battles that we've had, he's made a huge difference in many ways, you know, and I'm sure there are people who can hear us speaking now who have health care, health insurance, who wouldn't have had health insurance. There are probably auto workers who wouldn't be on the line but for the efforts that he made. There are military families who have their loved ones home instead of patrolling some dusty battlefield halfway across the world. And I could go on. Gay and lesbian Americans who have more rights today. And all of this, despite the fact that we have a difficult political environment. So my idealism is intact.
Talking to David Axelrod, longtime political consultant, previously a journalist. His new book is called Believer. He's looking back at his 40 years in politics. Well, let's talk about this long shot candidate for Senate you worked with, then long shot candidate for President Barack Obama. How did you get that gig? What did you think at the beginning?
Well, you know, I first met him in 1992 when he had just returned from law school. A friend of mine called up and said, "You got to meet this young man." And I said, "Why?" She said, "I think he could be the first black president of the United States." I always joke that I'd take that friend with me to the track all the time now, because she obviously knew how to spot winners. But I really just and we became friends. But I didn't really work with Barack until 2002, when he began running for the Senate for the 2004 race, and he was a very long shot. But I was so eager to work for him because I was at a point in my career where I wanted to recharge my idealism, and I thought helping him would be a good way to do it. And it was a real revelation to work with him, to see how he related to me. We'd go down to deep southern Illinois, and he would go into a veterans hall in a small town closer to Little Rock than Chicago, and he'd get a great reception. And he'd call me and tell me about it. I'd be surprised, and he'd say, "Well, no, these folks are just like my grandparents from Kansas." And I realized this is a guy who felt comfortable in any room in which he entered, whether it was downstate in this veterans hall or a inner city church or a Tony suburban parlor. I saw him. I was with him in 2002 when he made the decision to oppose the resolution to go into Iraq. And he said he feared a war of undetermined cost, length, and consequences that would unleash sectarian strife in the region and make America more of a fulcrum for terrorism and extremism. And of course, that turned out to be exactly right. So I learned about his prescience. And in that 2004 campaign, I also was with him when he wrote the speech for the 2004 convention, and I realized what a profound talent he was. So that was quite a journey in and of itself, that 2004 race, where we came from nowhere, won a big victory, and ended up with Obama as a major national political figure.
You were initially inspired by one Democratic president. You're going to be associated with another, Barack Obama. Is there a Republican politician who you'd point to as somebody, even if you disagree with them, that really has the sense of calling and service that you admire?
I'm sure that there are, and there are probably people running for president who reflect that, though. I shouldn't name them out of respect, so as not to destroy their chances by associating myself with them. But look, I look at a guy like Jeb Bush, for example. I think his family has a long and honorable history in politics. I think he approaches politics in that way. I don't agree with him on a number of things. I admire that he's been willing to stand up to some of the more strident voices in his own party on immigration reform. I know your own governor has made an adjustment on that issue, but Governor Bush has been steadfast on that. I admire him for that.
Now, we just talked on the show a little while back about how young people seem to be steering clear of politics. For a young person of either any political affiliation, your encouragement for them to start their own 40-year career in politics.
Yeah, well, that's really my mission now. I started this Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago for the express purpose of trying to persuade these young people that the public arena was a place to go and politics was a place to go to actually make a difference and effect real change. You know, I think this is the most public-spirited group of young people I've seen since the 1960s. They've lived through war. They've lived through financial crises. And they understand that everything is not certain and that you need to work for a better future. But they're really dubious about whether politics is the way to do it because they've seen so many bad examples. So their instinct is to say, let's create an app. Let's engage in social media. And all of that is very, very powerful. But it's also essential that we have leaders in public office who are leading us in the right direction. And I always tell them Congress is going to meet with them or without them. The state legislature is going to meet with them or without them. And you really don't have a right to complain about the choices that are made unless you're in there trying to influence those choices in some form or fashion. And so this is my mission now, is to try and encourage others to follow. It doesn't necessarily have to be in my footsteps, but to follow into the public arena and try and make a difference.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
So happy to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
That was David Axelrod, longtime political consultant, worked with President Obama since before he was president. His new memoir is Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. Whether they're on the right or left, it's common practice for American politicians and activists to invoke the founding fathers. They're what historian David Sahat calls a political football. Each side uses them to score points. Take the 2012 presidential election, for example. People in the Tea Party movement referred to Franklin and Jefferson to argue against President Obama's policies on things like health care and a bank bailout. In Obama's victory speech, he referred to the idea that hard work will help you get ahead as the founders promised. So how has our relationship with the founding fathers developed over the past couple hundred years? Is our political obsession with a group of founders a uniquely American thing? Do we use their wisdom in context? Do we use it wisely? Some of the questions that David Sahat tackles in his new book, The Jefferson Rule, How the Founding Fathers Became Infallible and Our Politics Inflexible. He's associate professor of history at Georgia State University, and he joins us now. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So our country is based on the laws enshrined in the Constitution, the one that these founding fathers started. Doesn't it make sense? Doesn't it seem natural to look to them for guidance and inspiration when we're figuring out how to tackle problems today?
Yes, it makes a certain amount of sense. But unfortunately, the founders didn't speak with one voice. And, if you go back to what they wrote and what they said and to their own political era, it was a deeply, deeply divided era. And they fought over things that we fight about, the proper meaning of the Constitution, the relationship between the federal and the state governments, whether the federal government ought to be involved in growing the economy or intervening in the economy in any ways. And so I'm just not sure that going back to the founders really helps us in a practical matter.
Talking to David Sahat about his new book, The Jefferson Rule, How the Founding Fathers Became Infallible and Our Politics Inflexible. I lost him for a moment. We'll get him right back on the line. In his new book, he looks at how politicians since the beginning have argued over the role the Constitution should play and what the Founding Fathers meant and sort of brandished them as a shield, a weapon on behalf of the arguments that they're trying to make, the policy debates of the day, whether that's today, Civil War era, FDR, Theodore Roosevelt, you name it. The new book, again, The Jefferson Rule, How the Founding Fathers Became Infallible and Our Politics Inflexible. We'll be debating or talking about one of those issues, the government's power to maintain airport security. That's coming up after the news at 4:30. As we try to get David Sahat back on the line now. You can weigh in on that issue, by the way, the TSA issue, over at the Central Time Facebook page. Have you been through airport security lately? Does the screening you see there make you feel safer? Do you think our federal government priorities, our funding levels for security to keep terrorist attacks away from airplanes are effective? timely money well spent, or are we wasting a lot of money? Head over right now to the Central Time Facebook page and share your thoughts there. Having trouble reaching David Sahat again, we can weigh in on this issue now at 800-642-1234. Do you think we put too much emphasis? Do we spend too much time arguing about what the founding fathers meant? Should we be looking to interpret what they said as strictly as possible, not deviate at all? Or should we be a little flexible, realize that they were fallible, as our guest makes the case, and that they didn't always agree with each other? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. And if you're a politics nerd like me and a history nerd, is there something from our founding fathers that you think we should be paying attention to from the people who started the country? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up after 6, by the way, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Back to the Land again. The Back to the Land spirit of the 1960s lives on today in the proliferation of farmers markets and the increased interest in sustainability and growing our own food. From the fight to end food waste in America to the art of living small, we'll find out what the Back to the Land spirit looks like today. We pick up our conversation now with David Sahat. David, before we lost you there, you were saying that our founding fathers didn't really speak in one voice. Build up on that a little.
Yeah, I mean, they disagreed about, you know, everything that we disagree about. They disagreed about the relationship of the federal and the state governments, the interpretation of the Constitution, and a whole lot of other things. So I'm just not sure that looking to them for really even in a kind of a authoritative interpretation of the Constitution is really going to be of help.
Well, how does drawing from their names, going back and pulling quotes, say, from Jefferson or George Washington, hurt politics? Isn't this mostly harmless?
You know, sometimes it's harmless, but other times it's really not. You know, for example, going into the Civil War, what the arguments of the founders did is it took policy disputes, you know, disputes about whether railroads should be built or how the federal government should be dealing with slavery, and it converted those disputes into more fundamental arguments over, you know, really the foundational principles of the nation. And as the United States marched into war, both sides were invoking the founding fathers. And you see that today as well, not war, but what are ordinarily policy disputes in which, you know, you and I might disagree and it would be sort of okay if we disagreed. Suddenly, when the founders become invoked, it's not okay that we disagree because one of us is betraying founding principle. And then that kind of poisons political debate and turns it really dysfunctional.
Is this something uniquely American?
Maybe it is. I mean, I have a hard time believing that a kind of renewal movement in France would develop with a sort of feverish call of return to the true meaning of the 1958 French Constitution. And you don't often see the Magna Carta, for example, invoked in British political debate. So I think it is somewhat uniquely American in this really this obsession with a group of people that lived now 200 years ago.
Looking at this from the perspective of the framers of the Constitution, do you think they would be surprised to see that they'd become almost sacred in the eyes of the people who came after them?
Maybe. But then again, you know, some of them lived long enough to actually see this process developing during their lifetimes. Really, almost as soon as the founding generation went off the public stage and this second generation came into American politics, and I'm talking about people like John Quincy Adams or Henry Clay or Andrew Jackson, people who didn't fight in the Revolution and who didn't draft the U.S. Constitution, they were of that second generation, and they began turning to the founders to establish their own legitimacy. And some founding fathers, you know, sort of became oracles. They would go and comment on public affairs, and they would be asked to comment on public affairs. And so, you know, maybe not. Maybe they wouldn't be surprised.
So what would a healthier political debate look like if we drop this reliance on cherry-picking the quotes of founding fathers that back up one side or the other?
You know, I've seen public opinion surveys that show a kind of a remarkable unanimity of opinion on a variety of issues. And even when people don't agree upon maybe solutions, they agree that there's a kind of a set of problems that ought to be addressed. And what I'd like to do is just stop talking about the Founding Fathers and start talking about solutions to those problems, because it seems to me that when people start talking about the Founding Fathers, they either don't have solutions or they can't think of anything else to say. And I think a more robust and healthy political debate would be that we debate, you know, our own solutions while not charging one another with bad faith, and we go about trying to address those problems as best as we can.
Very interesting. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's David Sahat. He's Associate Professor of History at Georgia State University. His new book is called The Jefferson Rule: How the Founding Fathers Became Infallible and Our Politics Inflexible. Yesterday, the Department of Homeland Security announced that the acting administrator for the Transportation Security Administration would be reassigned. That news followed a report that TSA airport screeners failed 95% of recent airport security tests, where undercover agents try to get fake weapons and bombs through the screening process. This news comes with summer vacations on the way, what's expected to be a busy season for air travel. John Mueller joins us now. He's a political scientist at The Ohio State University and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington. He's researched Homeland Security and TSA efforts. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Well, we'll dig into some of the deeper issues behind TSA and Homeland Security funding. But what was your initial reaction when you heard this news about this failure rate in this test of trying to get weapons and explosives past the screening?
I was surprised that it was as high as it is. 95% is pretty high, but the report hasn't come out yet, and I'm not sure exactly what they mean by weapons or explosives. But just intuitively, that seems to be a pretty high failure rate. There are, however, a large number of other layers of security on the airline, and there have been virtually no attempts by terrorists to do this, so I'm not really terribly concerned about it.
Right, so your gut reaction is not particularly more scared to fly than you were, say, 2 days ago.
No, what happens is that if you bring it's not clear why bringing a gun or a knife or something like that on board makes much sense. If you want to stab somebody or shoot somebody, you can do that, you know, much more efficiently in someplace else, not at close quarters. The obvious thing would be that you try to hijack the airline with a weapon, but you can't do that either because of locked cockpit doors, which are no longer opened generally for capricious reasons, and the fact that the crew and passengers will resist such an attempt. So basically it becomes extremely difficult even if you do get the weapon on. In the case of explosives, terrorists in the United States have been breathtakingly incapable of creating explosives by themselves. The only ones that have been put together are very primitive ones put together for the Boston Marathon bombing. Two explosives that went off in the in a crowded area, killing three people. That's three people too many, of course, but it's a very small number. It's only one or two per bomb. And those bombs would be almost incapable of downing an airliner. They're very small ones. So, the same in Britain, basically. No terrorist, no Muslim terrorist, certainly, since 2005, has been able successfully to detonate a bomb anyplace on an airplane or off. So it's not a major problem as far as I can see.
And now the news prompted the Department of Homeland Security to reassign the acting director of the TSA. DHS often accused of being in crisis mode, a reactive mode. Is this another example of that, do you think?
Yeah, it's management by inbox, it's frequently called, yes. What they should be saying is what I'm saying, and they're afraid to do so. What they should also be saying, your chance of being killed on an airliner is if you go back, 30 years and so forth, and look at the whole case of the terrorist attacks, your chance of being killed on an individual flight is about 1 in 80 or 90 million under present circumstances, which includes the 95% failure rate. If it's that low, then the question comes, is that safe enough? Is that acceptable risk? And they're simply incapable of bringing that out. Now, maybe you're not. Maybe you say that's not good enough. It has to be 1.5 million or something. Maybe it should be zero, in which case the only solution would be to ground all the airliners. If you want to do that, then you should say it. And so consequently, we just haven't had a coherent discussion about much of this. And the officials in charge basically are doing what you just said. They fire somebody who's been carrying out a policy that's been there for 10 years.
So looking at what was tested, what failed the test here, these screenings, anybody who flies has been through them maybe lots of times in the last 10, 15 years. Is this an effective and necessary and cost-effective anti-terrorism solution that we've got at all of our airports?
Yeah, it's not clear. My co-author and I, Mark Stewart, have done a couple of books and quite a few articles on this general area. And we've always assumed that the screening measures are more effective than 5%, for example. Though there are other screening measures such as no fly lists and so forth, which don't have anything to do with X-ray machines and so forth, that are also in place. Generally speaking, though, the whole array of security measures is really very effective overall. As I mentioned before, it's virtually impossible, even if you do get a weapon on, to do much with anything except shoot somebody, which, if you want to do it, would be, you can do that someplace else. You don't have to go out on an airplane to do that. And terrorists seem to be incredibly incompetent in terms of fashioning even very primitive bombs. So consequently, the situation is one of considerable safety. And if the chance of being killed is 1 in 80 or 90 million, one might also suggest that maybe that's too high. Maybe we want to relax things some, saving a lot of money potentially without necessarily reducing the risk, without necessarily increasing the risk very much at all. Those kinds of calculations are simply never there in public. We've done them in print, and we haven't had a problem getting them published, but they basically have had no impact on the airline industry and on the Transportation Security Administration, as far as we can see.
Talking about airport security with John Mueller, political scientist at The Ohio State University. After news that leaked, apparently, a lot of people trying to test the system, an official test of airport screening, managed to get a lot of hidden fake, I believe, weapons and fake bombs through at least the screening stage of airport security. Now, in your writing, in your work with your colleague, John, you've talked about a number of what you see as flaws in our security thinking. And one is a fear of the worst case scenario, a very unlikely but very devastating event. A lot of people will look at anti-terrorism efforts and think 9/11 happened. The worst case pretty much happened. Shouldn't we be doing everything we can to prevent another one?
Well, there's never been a terrorist event as massively destructive as 9/11, either before or after 9/11. There's been various efforts to try to think about putting one together, and they've basically never gotten very far. So 9/11 is standing out not as a harbinger, as it was a lot of people thought it would be shortly after 9/11, but basically as an aberration. And also, the more you look at the technical capacities of the terrorists, both the so-called masterminds in Al-Qaeda, as well as the decidedly not masterminds, like the Boston bombers and the guys picked up for various things within the United States, it's not a very impressive list set of people. In terms of capacities, and what 9/11 is looking more and more like was just a spectacular case of very horrible luck, not as something that you should take as being remotely normal.
Is the political problem here that nobody wants to be the politician who says we don't need the security effort, and then if something bad happens, to be the one blamed in hindsight?
Yes, that is the problem. Not only politicians, but also the head of the DHS and so forth. The people in the FBI, I've talked to them, who say we really we're really following up far too many leads. Since 9/11, for example, the FBI has followed up over 10 million terrorism leads in the United States. They think they ought to be able to toss some out, and that would be perfectly rational, so they could throw out the ones that are very unlikely and concentrate on the ones that are more likely. But he says we simply can't do that. Because what you're saying, they're worried that if something bad goes on, it happens, they will be cashiered. My argument basically is that if you're unwilling to make difficult decisions when you are working on public safety, which is the most important thing governments do, for the first words in the Constitution practically are preserve domestic tranquility, and if you're unwilling to do that responsibly, in other words, spend the money in a manner that maximizes public safety with the limited amount of money you have, you shouldn't take the job in the first place. if you say, well, I've got this job, but if I do a responsible job, I might lose my job. That's very comparable, it seems to me, to a soldier who says, I'm not going into combat, of course. I'm just joined up for the food. I didn't go, you know, you can't say that. Or a firefighter who goes into a burning building who says, well, I actually joined the fire force so I can catch up on my sleep. Those are not acceptable excuses. And it seems to me that for a decision maker who took a job in which he might have to make career-threatening decisions, it's not an excuse to say, well, I can't make a career-threatening decision because I'll lose my career, any more than a soldier can say, I'm not going to go into a firefight. If you don't like that, you shouldn't have taken it in the first place. And if you're not willing to accept that responsibility, you should resign.
Now, as you've pointed out in your writing, this involves kind of a complicated form of thinking where you can say, yes, throwing lots of money into these anti-terrorist efforts makes us maybe a little safer, but the money spent in other ways, maybe on other issues completely, might make us a lot safer, improve our quality of life in ways that outweigh the little bit of risk we captured there. It was complicated in the way I just said it, even. So how do we change our thinking that way?
Well, what you're talking about is simply responsible policy analysis. You don't have an infinite amount of money to spend. There are some hazards which cause great problems and some that don't. And furthermore, the remedies against some hazards are very expensive and others are very cheap. For example, smoke alarms are very cheap things, of course, and overall they save a fair number of lives at an extremely low cost. So if you're spending billions of dollars to save one life from a terrorist event and refusing to spend the same on something else, it might save many, many times that many those lives, then you're not spending the money responsibly. So that's the way it should be. It's done throughout the government for various things. If you come in and say, I want to force people to have seat belts in the back seat of their cars, well, you have to explain it. You have to say, okay, well, how many lives is that going to save? And how much is it going to cost? And if the number of lives you're going to save is very, very small and the cost is very, very high, you don't do it, even though it might save some lives here and there. You'd much rather come in and say, this can save a huge number of lives, it is not terribly expensive, and let's do it. So that kind of calculation has to be done all the time. Physicians or drug companies and so forth have a new remedy. You have to explain what the benefits are and what the costs are in terms of economic costs as well as side effects and so forth. It's a standard sort of thing. Any safety measure, any medical measure in which human life is part of the calculation, you have to undergo that. And why that should not be the case in terrorism is totally not clear to me. But by and large, it has not been done in a sensible way. The same kind of sensible way it's done in other parts of the government.
We're talking to political scientist John Mueller about terrorism risk and the TSA. Our starting point, the news that the TSA airport screeners failed to catch almost all attempts to smuggle weapons or explosives onto planes conducted by an undercover team. And we're taking your calls, too. What was your reaction to the news? Do you think the TSA is doing a good job? Do you feel safer after you've been screened at the airport? And big picture, do you think we have the right priorities when it comes to airport security, or are we spending a lot with not a lot to show for it? What do you think we should do differently? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now about airport security, a news that TSA screeners failed to stop 95% of weapons and fake bombs in a test from coming through airport screening checkpoints. We're talking to John Mueller, political scientist at The Ohio State University, senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington, and you can join in too. Do you feel safer because of these TSA screenings when you fly somewhere? Have you ever traveled in other countries? What do you think of the way they do these things as compared to the way we do them in the United States? And do you think we're putting a lot of money into this kind of security that could be better spent elsewhere? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. We've got John on the line in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. I'd like to disagree with Mr. Mueller on a point he made. He was saying that in the decision-making process to establish anti-terrorism law, that what we would weigh is if there are a few lives to be lost here and there, it was worth it if we could save many more lives later on. And I think that that's an oversimplification, and that we do need to bring ethical considerations into how we decide how we're going to run our lives individually and as a country.
John, thanks for the call. I don't know if he quite summed up what you meant there. John, do you think that was a fair characterization?
Well, I'm not sure. I missed part of it there. It seems to me that basically when you think about damage that terrorists do, for example, you do not only include the physical damage, the property and lives lost, but also the possible fears, stop in the stock market, cuts in tourist trade and so forth, and general anxiety. So that has to be part of the calculation, but that has to be for other things too. Cancer may be a worse disease than certain other diseases because it causes so much anxiety, and that's part of the cost of it. So so basically what you have is a set of hazards, and they cause a certain amount of damage. And what you want to do is to reduce the damage or reduce the likelihood that the damage will be inflicted at a reasonable cost. And so the calculation is very much the same. It's not simply that you don't involve emotion or worry or anxiety. What you do is you include that in the cost of the event. Some people are, you know, much more afraid of nuclear radiation than is probably wise. But the fact that people do have those fears means that probably you'd want to spend more than you would normally on trying to reduce the danger of nuclear radiation, because it causes not only damage, but it also causes excessive fears. So having the fears considered is part of the calculation. And you want to do that reasonably objectively across the board. You want to do it for things which don't cause anxiety, only cause damage and physical damage, as well as ones that do have a lot of emotion tied into them, such as nuclear radiation or terrorism.
Thanks for the call, John. We'll go next to Mark in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I both agree and disagree with your guest. I agree in concept with his comments about balancing the risk with your how much you get out of it. For example, there is no way the FBI can actively or efficiently or effectively follow up on 10 million leads. If you think about it, that's just under a million leads a year, and there's no way that they can do an effective job on all those leads. Something's going to slip through the crack. On the other hand, I do disagree because of a lack of a successful terrorist attack using guns or knives is not proof that their risk does not exist, especially when you consider the fact that the information now is out in the public that the TSA has not done a very good job of screening this type of activity.
Mark, thanks for the call. John, so he agrees with you part of the way that we can't do everything, but he sees a value and a real risk here.
Well, there is a real risk, but the idea is to keep it in context. Your chance of being killed by a terrorist is generally in the United States, including 9/11 in the calculation, is about 1 in 4 million per year. That's where you should start. Now, you want to, as I mentioned before, you don't not only deal with the cost in terms of lives, but also the other things that terrorism frequently causes, such as anxiety. That's reducing anxiety is not infinite good. And so, consequently, you have basically a base rate of how frequently these things happen under current conditions. And if your chance of being killed is 1 in 4 million per year, whereas your chance of being killed in an automobile accident, for example, is 1 in 8,000 per year for an American, you probably want to spend a lot more time worrying about the 1 in 8,000 chance than 1 in 4 million chance, even though the 1 in 4 million does have some emotional component. So it's as I said before, it's basically the kind of thing that's required in government for any kind of measure that tries to improve human safety. You also have to keep in mind, of course, that the budgets are not infinite. So consequently, it's required, in fact, by government regulations, agreed upon, by the way, throughout the world, that kind of calculation is the way it should be handled. And what's happened is that the terrorism hazard has not been handled in that way at all. It's basically been the sort of management by inbox thing. Someone's getting on a plane with explosives in their underwear and so forth, so now we have to deal with that issue by bringing out very expensive machines to try to reduce it. If you're going to bring out the very expensive machines, you have to calculate how much it's likely to reduce that threat. Very expensive generally means that it's not likely to be cost-effective. Some measures are very cheap. I mentioned before the issue about crew and passenger resistance, someone who might try to hijack an airliner. Now, that's a very strong security measure, and it costs practically nothing. You may have to do a little bit of crew training, but that's about it. People will do it naturally. So if you can find remedies like that, risk-reducing remedies like that, they are obviously ones to be very much preferred. Extremely expensive ones, such as body scanners or the federal air marshals, which cost about $1 billion a year and reduce risk very little, are a different matter entirely.
Back to our callers now with Victor in West Allis. Victor, hi.
Hi. Thank you for answering my call. I have two parts to your question. One is, on the TSA, I'm getting one of my experiences. They're trying to rush people, rushing people through so the American public or the tourist public doesn't get upset by standing around. In regards to the comment overseas, my wife and I like going to Germany a lot. And there's two instances. One, I had a bulky denim shirt on. She had me take it off because she thought it was too loose-fitting. And then when I was...